Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
If you've suffered an injury in an accident and would like a free case review, make sure you call the super team at Daspit Law Firm. Free consultations are available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Dial 713-CALL-NOW. That's 713-CALL-NOW. Or you can go to the website, DaspitLaw.com.
Broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, it's John and Lance
on ESPN 97.5 and
92.5. All right, 901 here on ESPN 97.5, and joining us right now, it's been a few years since we had Heather Denich on from ESPN. We called her college football's mom because she was taking her kids. It just kind of made sense. She was taking her kids to school the last time we spoke, and she is... you're a calm voice, Heather. You're a voice of reason in college football. You have the crazy Peter Burns is out there, who's a friend of mine. I can call Peter crazy. The Josh Pates out there, who we have on every Thursday. And we always love having you on, and I appreciate you joining us this morning.
Yeah, thank you guys so much. And I'm not driving my kids to school this morning, but if someone can take them there, that would be wonderful.
I was really happy when my son was old enough and my dad gave him a car and he could drive to school. Well, I didn't care so much as my wife did, but because I'm here doing radio all the time. It is nice for him to go pick up things for us now. Like, hey, run and get something from the store. I don't have to do it.
Yes.
Heather, so you wrote yesterday, there was an article about strength of schedule and the college football playoffs and the selection committee. And then speaking of schedule, this morning I'm reading the article that you wrote about the SEC schedule changes and what's taking place. Now, we know with the expansion of the college football playoffs to 12 and the money that's involved, all the conferences want to get as many of their teams in as possible, and there are now standards from a schedule standpoint. Talk about, can you tell everyone about what the standards now are from a schedule standpoint and what the SEC is doing now as a conference to work inside of those parameters?
Well, the SEC schedule just got a lot more difficult. And it's not just playing a ninth conference game. It's also the fact that they added that ninth conference game. And they still are required to play another Power Four opponent. So you're going to see more SEC teams with 2-3 losses. I mean, that's just a matter of fact. It's just more difficult to get to the SEC championship and win a national title unscathed. But when you look at the changes that the college football playoff made to its metrics this offseason, they've enhanced some things that help the committee evaluate strength of schedule. But college football fans aren't really going to notice much of a difference when those 6 weekly rankings come out, because the reality is they just put into metrics and numbers what the human element has already been doing. And what do I mean by that? I mean, when Clemson and LSU play in their season opener, assuming it's a close game, the loser of that game is not out of the college football playoff because they lost to an elite team. Now, if you win that game, it helps you more significantly in the computers maybe than it did a year ago. How much? I'm not entirely sure. But if you're Notre Dame and you lose to Northern Illinois, you're going to get dinged for that in the metrics more than in the past. There's a new metric called record strength, and it's going to help the committee members evaluate how teams performed against those schedules. So remember, the SEC is not going to 9 league games until 2026. So for this year, basically everything stays the same. I don't expect college football fans to see major changes when those rankings come out.
Heather, Will Kunkel here. It kind of brings me to, I love college football. I absolutely love it. I watch it every Saturday. But one of my least favorite things about it is that everybody's graded differently. Everybody's got a different test in order to get to the playoffs. How do we get to a point where it's like the NFL, from the sense of everyone's like on a level playing field, to make this actually make sense of who gets in and why they get in? Is that ever going to happen?
I don't think it's ever going to happen. Jeez. It never has, and I'll be surprised if it ever does. And that's because college football in itself has been so unique in terms of the disparity, not just in the old days when there were divisions, but within the leagues themselves from top to bottom. I mean, you can talk about which one is more top-heavy, which one is the deepest conference. Every single league has the Wake Forest of the world, right? With all due respect to the little old school in the FBS, everybody has a school that's not competing at the level of Clemson, Ohio State, Alabama. You know, it's just that's the reality of it. So what can you do to even it? Well, the ACC can now go to 9 games to at least make everybody on the same playing field in terms of playing the same amount of conference games. But it's just not going to be like that because college football is unequal.
And you know, the only way you get there is you have to have fewer teams. I mean, teams have to break away. The SEC and the Big Ten would have to break away from everyone else. Then all of a sudden you'd have an amount of teams where your schedules, you could have like schedules. You'd have to play more games to make it like the NFL, where your schedules could start to become more, you know, parity driven. And that's really the only way that you can do it. So I don't think it's, like you said, I don't think it's built to where it can ever, there's simply too many teams, too many conferences. I don't think it can ever get to be like the NFL, where you have the same standards for everyone. You're always going to have some apples and oranges from time to time. But, you know, getting back for a second to the strength of schedule metric, I find that curious because there's no question that inside of the discussions that are being had by the college football playoff committee, they're obviously discussing quality of wins and strength of schedule, are they not?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think what happened last year to bring this to the forefront of the conversation was everyone watched what Indiana did. A lot of people said Indiana didn't play a Power 4 non-conference opponent. They didn't have any wins against top 25 teams. They had the number 68 strength of schedule in the country. And then everyone else says, yeah, but they beat the snot out of everybody. And they had one of the best quarterbacks in the country. And they were a good football team. And then somebody says, yeah, until they played Ohio State, Notre Dame. And it's just like, we can argue about this all day because it's college football. But the fact that Indiana was a college football playoff team with one of the worst schedules in the country and ranked ahead of some other teams that played more difficult schedules, that has everybody to step back who are decision makers in the process and say, are we doing this the best way that we possibly can? Let's reevaluate how the committee looks at these schedules. But the reality is that the people in the room, the majority of them, played or coached football. And you have to understand, they're sitting there watching these games just like you and I. And when you see the way the games unfold, it impacts the decisions. When you're watching SMU Clemson and you see in the ACC championship game, SMU is playing an entirely different second half than it did in the first half, that changed opinions in the room, just like everyone else watching that game. And had that second half been like the first half, they wouldn't have been in the college football playoffs. I'm pretty darn certain of that. So it's also a matter of the human element watching these games and these teams and saying, you know what? I don't care that they didn't play anybody. They're a really good football team, and they won every game that they did by at least 30 points.
Yeah, at some point you have to judge the team for the team, and you're going to have these arguments, but there are going to be some teams that just stand out despite what their schedule is. I always believe from my old handicapping background, I believe that how you play these opponents matters a lot. So if you take a lesser opponent and you blow the doors off of them, that should matter. I mean, if you're that much better, you should beat them handily. Similarly, if you play a tough schedule, but you're really struggling against lesser teams, I mean, how you play is just as important. It's frankly maybe even a little more important than who you're playing. I think how you're playing has to be considered across the board, even if you have a lesser schedule.
Yes. How you win and how you lose has to matter, because as we talk about the Clemson-LSU game and say the loser of that game is not out of the college football playoff, that's true. But do they lose by a field goal, or do they lose like Clemson lost to Georgia? Because that's a disparity between what's supposed to be the ACC's best team and a college football playoff team. when I'm talking about Clemson, Georgia last year, right? So what is the gap there? The scoring margin helps indicate that a little bit. But also, how much better are those teams in November than when they play each other in the season opener? And the committee pays attention to that, too, especially when you've got first-year starting quarterbacks for a lot of these teams, seven of the top 10 teams.
I'm curious what you think about this NIL deal and how it's impacting football, in particular SMU now ranked in the top 25. It seems like they have a ton of money now, Texas Tech. I went to Northwestern. We've got a ton of money. We got to get a stadium first, check that box, and then we'll go from there. But do you see teams that have not been perennially good at football have the ability to be good at football because they can just buy players? Like, do you see the landscape of college football changing with some teams throughout the country?
Well, I think Texas Tech is going to be a big experiment with that this year, because if they're not in the Big 12 championship game, there's going to be a lot of people who poured money into that program.
Oh, they're going to be pissed.
They're going to be pissed, right? I mean, so that's reality of it. But also now with a system that is supposed to be more transparent and enforceable in terms of these NIL deals, I think it's going to take a year or two maybe to see how that plays out and how that impacts the rosters and the recruiting and all these things. I just don't think that you can sit here and say right now, well, this is what it looks like. But when you look at what it was going into this season, I think it's certainly fair to say that can literally be game-changing money at a place like Texas Tech.
Do you see certain schools losing some footing? Because we've heard rumors of Alabama and having to fundraise more. I mean, I find it hard to believe that they fall off the face of the earth and don't have a powerhouse program, of course. But, right. Someone like Texas, they got a ton of money. They can do whatever they want, whereas they have more money than Alabama. So there is certainly a shift taking place. Do you see other schools maybe losing some of that control that they've had, for over the last couple decades?
I'm not sure about that, because there's always been a disparity. Just like we talk about the inequity on the field, like there's the financial inequity off of it. And is it going to make it bigger? Is it going to exacerbate it? I don't think it could get much worse than what happened when there weren't NIL regulations or an office that all of these had to go through. But at the same time, and to your point, the Alabamas of the world have budgets too. I mean, I've talked to athletic directors about this. People, and yes, you're right. Places like Texas, there's so much money. There's so much money going around. But at the same time, it's not just paying players this $20 million cap or whatever it is. I mean, you've got stadium renovations. Penn State is pouring buku bucks into its stadium renovation right now. And you see a lot of donations throughout the country. Kansas just got one. There was another one somewhere else. But at some point, you get something that happens like at Michigan, where they've got these sanctions and the NCAA hits you in the pocket and it's at least $30 million. I mean, that hurts, even if you're Michigan.
It does. And, talking to some teams, like, there are going to be some teams that really, the haves, the big teams, they're going to be fine with the rev share. There are other teams where the rev share is really hurting them. The teams that don't generate as much revenue and that really are trying to fund the rest of their athletic programs. That's why I think there's eventually going to be a split between the haves and the have-nots financially, because they're just going to be playing. I mean, this is really turning into international soccer, where you have a few teams that can really compete at the highest financial level. I do think that this, that the cap that they put in here, it's 16.5 million, I believe, for football. You can spend 21, 22 million total for your athletic program. That is supposed to even the playing field a little bit. But then the NIL, if you can get pushed through real NIL deals, that's going to be a big difference maker for the high dollar clubs too. Universities, I mean.
Yeah. No, I think those are all fair points. But like I said, I do think that it'll take a year or two for it all to shake out, to see what it's like under the new system with the NIL and what gets flagged and what gets sent back and all that. But yep. I just hope from a reporter's perspective that there is transparency about it so that you could see the numbers and what's really happening. Because, man, for the last couple of years, it's just reports like, oh, this program's putting $40 million. Well, where is it? show me the money, right? Mm-hmm. Like how is this actually happening, and is this real? Because a lot of these numbers and reports have been inflated, but there's no question that there's millions of dollars being poured into these programs.
That's Heather Dinich from ESPN. Heather, thanks so much for joining us, and don't be a stranger. We'll reach out to you again, and we'd love to get you back on.
Sounds good, guys. Thanks so much.
All right, let's break it right here. When we come back, Rafael Stone, general manager of the Houston Rockets, is set to join us. There's a little trap. We got a little construction here in the Galleria area around us, so we've got to make sure that we can guide the general manager on in. Taqueria Sarandas is out in our atrium, lining up to serve food. We're all excited about that, of course. So when we come back, Rafael Stone, tell your friends, tell your neighbors, the Houston Rockets GM, up next on ESPN 97.5.
But first, I'm going to talk to you about John Daspit.
Yeah, let's talk about John Daspit. That's what I was waiting for you to kind of cue me on that. John Daspit is a personal injury lawyer who's the best here in Houston. You see his commercials during sporting events. He's big into sports, huge sports talk listener, and has been in the NIL scene doing real NIL deals the way they're supposed to be for name, image, and likeness. But he does that. But the main thing is, look, he's out there trying to do the best he can for the people who are his clients. And his clients, he's working hard for them to make sure that they get treated fairly. He passionately pursues justice for the injured. And so if you've been in an accident at the workplace, out on the roadways, at a location of any kind, he's going to make sure that those medical bills get taken care of. He's going to make sure your time that you miss from work is taken care of. Your pain and suffering is accounted for. That's the difference with John Daspit. 60-plus lawyers working in the state of Texas for you. Go to DaspitLaw.com. Or call 713-CALL-NOW to get started today.
You're back in the Veritex Community Bank Studios with John and Lance
on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
All right, 9:23 here on the show. Joining us right now, as advertised, Rafael Stone, general manager of the Houston Rockets. First of all, thanks for taking time to come in studio. We got some Mexican food out there, but I got to get Sam to bring us some plates in so we can eat while we do it, kind of like a podcast or something. But thanks for coming in studio. What a ride. What a ride for you personally. You worked with the Houston Rockets, not in a general manager capacity, obviously, but you've been here for Jeff Van Gundy. Why don't you tell everyone, how long have you been here? I didn't realize you were here for JVG as well.
Yeah, we worked together for a year, something like that, a year and a half. I came towards the end of the 2004-2005 season. So I've been,
golly,
I've been around for a minute. Yeah.
And so you have seen the ups and downs, McGrady and Yao. You were there for McGrady and Yao.
Yep.
You've been every iteration of James Harden Rockets. And now we're in a new cycle. As someone who has been a lifelong Rocket fan, this is the new cycle of Houston Rockets. And you are the architect of that, along now with, obviously, with the help of Ime Udoka, the head coach. I do want to ask you, I mean, you've had a Midas touch with a lot of these first-round picks that you've had. How much have you learned from Ime as it pertains to the type of person you want to draft? Or, I don't know, you can answer it yourself. What have you learned from Ime as it pertains to the evaluation process?
I've learned a ton from Ime. I don't think much, if anything, on the evaluation process. Like, almost everybody kind of came in, like the bulk of the team came in before Ime joined us.
Mm-hmm.
I think on that front, it's almost like the inverse, which is that, like, the things that I really value in players, he does too, and he knows how to enhance. So it's almost like we're doing our thing in the front office, and we're trying to identify these guys who can play. And what's made the partnership with Ime awesome is that the types of guys that we gravitate to, he likes them, but also he knows what to do with them, and he makes them better, and he's done a very good job developing them. So it's been kind of a really seamless fit, but kind of the inverse. Like I'm not I'm old. I'm not great at changing, like in some respects. Right. Like, you know, I try and always be learning and everything else, but big fundamental changes are probably not in store for me in terms of the way I approach things. So what I found is that he's just the perfect partner, or thus far has been the perfect partner to kind of work with.
One thing I love about Ime is his standard and his ability to have accountability on the team. We saw it several years while trying to build this culture. And like, you're going to sit next to me if you're not doing what I'm asking you to do late in games, No matter who you are. And people think that that's hard to do in the NBA because it seems unique to have a defensive standard in particular. But with him, is it easier to build a team because you do have a standard and you can weed out exactly what you don't want?
It's much easier to having a really good head coach, which obviously he is it's crucial to building a team. You know, and you can – people have won in the NBA in a billion different ways. The best way to win is to get some transcendent player who, like, you know, who gives you some enormous advantage. But you know, that there's an enormous amount of luck. I mean, if you need to have the best player on earth in order to win – you know, only one out of 30 teams can possibly do that. And so, obviously you want to get the best players you can get, but you never want to be dependent upon kind of that type of luck, you know? And so then having a head coach who can build something, that's greater than the whole, the sum of its parts, is enormously important. And I think Ime is great for that.
Two guys that you had a lot of success with are second picks in the first round. And historically, it doesn't happen a whole lot where the second pick that you have in the first round is as impactful as Alperen and Tari Eason have been for your team. I mean, especially Alperen. I want you to take us through Alperen, because Jalen Green was the easy decision, I would assume, with the first pick in that draft that you had, the first round pick. And Jalen was a good player. Jalen wasn't as consistent shooting and things like that, and we know, and he's been moved, and Kevin Durant, we can talk about that in a second. Alperen quickly established himself as a core player and has done nothing but go up. What did you see? What was your process with Alperen Şengün when you brought him in? And did he even exceed your expectations up to this point?
I don't think I would say with all these guys, like we hope, like he's hit kind of the upside of what we hoped.
Yeah.
But we definitely saw it. We wouldn't have. I mean, we traded two first round picks to get him.
To get up.
Yeah. And so we wouldn't have done that if we didn't see somebody who could be this type of impactful player. There are guys who can be very good, and then there are guys who maybe can be a little bit more than that. And so we saw that. I mean, on Jalen, like no pick is easy. Like the second pick in the draft is like sometimes the
big
first
bus rate.
Yeah,
for
yeah,
all of them.
Yeah. Sometimes the first pick in the draft is easy, but even then you're nervous. It's just more. There's this enormous consensus, and you're not going to buck it. But once you get past one, it's never like a no brainer. That's A. But B, yeah, on Alperen, he was the MVP of the Turkish league, which is it's definitely a top four or five league in the world.
Older men, I mean, grown men playing that, right? When he was a young guy.
No, like guys making like $5 million a year, $6 million a year, like really good players. When you watch the Olympics or you watch the World Championships and you watch these guys play and you're like, boy, that's like, because there'll be NBA players sprinkled in, and all these guys look like the NBA guys. Like, there's not a difference. Mm-hmm. Yeah, those guys are playing professionally, whether it's in Spain or Turkey or whatever. And yeah, and he was the MVP of that league at 18. The only two people who've had comparable success in top tier leagues are Jokic, who had it the year after he was drafted. So kudos to Denver because they drafted him before he dominated his league, and Luka. And so I thought good indicator. And then just watching film, like he just does special stuff. Like it was tough. It was COVID. Like I never met him in person because you couldn't. He was just a huge target. We picked Jalen, and then I don't know. I think starting at like pick six, I started throwing stuff. We were very much trying to come out of that draft with those two guys. And I started throwing stuff at teams, trying to trade up all the way. Yeah, like immediately after we made our first pick, we were trying to get him, and we were lucky we got him.
How much light can you shine on how the Kevin Durant trade came about, moving Jaylen, and then when you're done with that, like what's that night like for you when you're done with it? Do you just sit back and celebrate, or what do you do?
You know, no, definitely didn't celebrate. It was long, like, you know, that we understood what they wanted to get for Kevin, and it just didn't make sense for our team starting, I don't know, a year ago. Mm-hmm. And so there were just all these conversations, and just, it was a very, very long process. I think the thing about it from my perspective, obviously we did the trade. We're really happy with it. And, I've gotten to know him a little bit, and I'm really happy with him as a person. But the flip of that is as people and as coworkers, Dylan and Jaylen were just awesome. And we were the number two seed last year on a very, very, very young team. And I thought we played Golden State really tough. And so,
I still think you guys are the better team. We're the better team.
I mean, they won. Yeah. So, you know, like it is what it is. But I think that, you know, we really liked our group, and I really liked them. And I just have a ton of, goodwill, thankfulness. I don't know what the right word is, for both Jaylen and Dylan. And just in terms of what they gave to me as a person, to our organization. I mean, like never once with either of those guys did I feel like they didn't care. They weren't giving me everything they had. And we asked both of them to do really hard things, and they did it with a smile on their face. And, you know, and they were just awesome. I think they played the two most games of anybody over that 2 year
Jaylen
period.
Was a horse.
No, like
he showed up.
Like, and it's not like he just stayed healthy, guys. Like, I mean, he'd come in like limping. You're like, oh, he ain't going tonight. And then like, he'd be on the table for 2.5 hours and be like, nah, I'm out there. I met you.
So my son Mason came up to say hi, and so he's, you know, you let him come and say hi when he turned 16, which I appreciate. And you introduced us after practice to Kevin Porter Jr. And I know you really liked him on a personal
Kevin?
Level.
Yeah, he's super likable. Yeah,
that's why I wondered. I feel like you really get attached to some of these guys who you've drafted, who you've watched grow up. And Jaylen's a guy who grew up inside right. the system. How difficult was that for you making? I mean, from a basketball standpoint, no question, you understand that move completely. On a personal level, how tough was making that move? Because I can tell you, Rocket fans, it was kind of split when we'd talk about it, because everyone had kind of, you know, this was our little team that had come up, and you feel a lot of affection for these guys.
No, it's extraordinarily hard, because like you can't fake. You either like people or you don't like people. You can't fake relationships.
Right.
And again, like I'm not, and I'm really bad at faking. Like, you know, so like one of the, you know, I didn't joke. I am old. Like one of the things that comes with kind of age is you get to know yourself a little bit, right? And so like either I'm in or I'm not. Like that's just me, right? And so with our guys, I'm in. Like I want them to be the best they can possibly be. And the way I do that is like the way I help them is like whatever you need, I'll give on a personal level. Like what, you know, I'm going to be there for you, right? And I am. And especially when like, I don't know, 5 years ago now, I think it was 5 years ago, maybe it was even six, but like we kind of like, we were like, okay, we're on this path. We're going to go young and we're going to bring in, you know, a bunch of 18, 19, 20 year olds. Like, they're the same age as my kids. That they're younger than I have twins who are 23. So a bunch of these guys are, most of them are younger than my kids, and very much like obviously you love your children and you want the best for them and everything else. And these aren't my children. It's not the same. But the point is, I want to pour into them. I went about it like I'm going to pour into them like I would want someone to pour into my kid. It, you know, as their career is developing and on and off the court. Sorry.
Oh, no. That's all right. Dell wants to ask a question as well.
During trade negotiations or the process, the insiders who report to the public the news of what's going on position it like a high-stakes card game where they're playing each other against each other. This team wants this. This team wants that. How is it for the guys inside? Does it feel like that, or is it kind of a very relaxed situation as you guys figure out how it's going to work?
It's probably neither. You know, like, it's definitely not like the intensity level that people think on social media is definitely wrong. It's not like we're not at a poker table with looking at reads. You know, you're not doing that, right? But it's definitely not relaxed because you've got too much to do. And in the NBA is a pretty illiquid market. And so things tend to condense around the trade deadline, kind of the week before, and then kind of, you know, 2 weeks before the draft, something like that. And so because you know that those are the periods to get deals done, if you're negotiating on one deal, you're also juggling 10 other things that might pop up and might end up being more interesting, you know? And so I'd say it's neither, but, you know, it's and then a lot of the stuff on social media or the insiders are just lies. Like, many of the insiders are not insiders. They're literally just talking to get clicks or to get views.
Yeah, really,
or whatever.
Is like that. We always think that's probably like that with some of those guys, but
yeah, no. Like, there will be people who say, and we have a really small front office. The Rockets do. We're the smallest in sports because I can't talk to 100 different people. Like, and I don't see the point of having a bunch of people that don't have input. Like, I want everybody who works with us to like
to matter,
yeah. Right? Yeah. And so they'll say, you know, I talked to a Rockets executive and they're thinking this. And I know what I'm thinking. And I'm definitely not thinking that. And the odds that they somehow randomly talk to one of the three other people who are in discussions on this, who like don't talk to the media at all. Like, no, they didn't talk to him, right? Like, there's no, they didn't talk to him at all. And so they just went out there and lied, you know? And maybe they talked to, like, somebody in season ticket sales. I don't know what they did.
I got a call the other day from one of your season ticket
guys.
Good,
like, you should have bought.
I said, that was my father-in-law's account. I was just on.
Do you have to combat that? Like, do you have to combat those rumors?
You
ever?
Don't, though. You rarely do.
No, I just not. Yeah.
I just mean with, like, the people you're working with. I don't mean publicly. Like, do they ever, like, is this true? Like, is this?
No, well, like, if there's one that really bothers me, I will double check to make sure that, like, that happened. Somebody wrote this summer. It wasn't a bad one, but they wrote this extensive thing saying that they talked to a Rockets executive. And then they said that they also talked to a Rockets coach. But it was like a verbatim quote. And I was like, there's no chance one of my guys said it. And they didn't. They didn't say it. So that person just wrote, I don't know if they talked to a coach or not, in fairness, but I know it 100% they didn't talk to an executive. And I'm like, if you're going to give somebody a diatribe on a player, which was this was, then like, let's make sure that we're aligned on it. But again, it didn't happen.
Right.
And so, but there's also no consequences for the media members who do this. Like, they just, there's just no consequences.
No, that's true. You got from the hunter to the hunted. No one expected you to do what you did last year. So now the mindset will change a little bit for players because now it's less about making the playoffs or, you know, competing. It's ramped with Kevin Durant, it's ramped up.
City wants that parade.
It's ramped up. The city's excited. And we've seen it happen with the Astros before. You've been here. You know what happened with the Astros. They had a young core, they grew together. I can see a similar pathway. I think the Texans are kind of running parallel with you guys. There's a lot of similarities between D'Amico and Ime and you and Nick Caserio and some of the growth that we've seen with young core drafted players. Is there a different mindset? How do you view it now? Because teams are gunning for the Rockets. You're not a surprise to anybody anymore. How does that change things for you, for Ime, for the players?
I mean, I hope it doesn't. Like, first of all, we're definitely still the hunters. Like, we didn't win anything. So, like, we need to be hunting, right? Yeah. And so, but no, I mean, like, I get that public perception changes year to year. I think internally, we expected to be as good as we were last year. And we were very unhappy when we lost basketball games. I do think that Ime and I were talking about this like 2 days ago. That's one thing we need to make sure we don't lose. We were the most unhappy team when we were losing. Like, we did not lose gently. We did not lose
that's a good thing.
No, it's a good thing.
Does that come from Ime? Does that come from?
I think it comes. I give Ime a ton of credit for it. I do think it's an organizational thing. Like, yeah,
you drafted guys like that. Like, Jabari strikes me as a good guy to have. Yeah. I always thought that was a really good pick people, I think he gets lost a little bit. I always felt like his attitude and the way he approaches everything, I'm sure a lot of it comes from his dad. I felt like he was a really good pick for you for this is the kind of guy you want on that roster.
Yeah, but by the time we picked Jabari, I think we had a good sense of where directionally where we're going. He's fit great. Tari too. Like,
yeah.
Tari's just a dull, like,
Amen.
And then Amen and Dylan were the two like outliers. And so we need to like, we're going to miss Dylan in that respect, but like, and Amen and Tari and Jabari and those guys just got the same.
It seems like he's wired. He is really wired up the way you want an elite competitor wired. Is what it seems like.
No, losing isn't his thing. And then I skipped over Fred, but I shouldn't have. Like, Fred's probably the toughest player in the NBA. And Fred's like 100% all about winning. All the rest of the stuff doesn't matter.
How about him boxing with Ime? You like that?
Oh, everybody is. Like, they got the video of that. But no, all those guys are. Like, Amen and Ime were sparring the other day. Like Ime came in, like, talking about how they're both supposed to be pulling their punches and neither was good at it. Yeah, no, like the whole it's just cardio and conditioning, and everybody's been getting it in the summer. They're doing a really good job.
What are your expectations for Reed Sheppard? Because everyone I've talked to says like legitimately great things about him and what he can do. And the reason he didn't play was just there weren't minutes there for him. It had nothing to do with skill and talent. What do you guys expect for him this year?
Yeah, I mean, I think we expect him to build off last year. Like, he kind of was creeping up, and then I think around the midpoint of the year, he really got comfortable. His play started to really improve, and at the very end of the season, we were able to get him extended minutes. He played really well in those games offensively. He's got some really special defensive tools, and so we need him to kind of combine those with being solid, and he's done a good job of working on his kind of being solid and being physical all summer. We just need Reed to take a step. I think he's really, really talented. But it is hard. Like, generally speaking, if you're a top 3, 4, 5 pick, especially as a guard, the team that picks you is a lottery team, and they give you the ball, and you get a chance to like play through mistakes. And we couldn't give it to him. We couldn't get, if you think about it, the prior year, Amen was in the exact same situation. Mm-hmm. And we gave him a little bit, and Amen's different just because, like, okay, if you can't play the one, we'll put you at the five. Like, what Amen can just play every position. And so he actually, if you think about how he carved out his initial role, it was without the ball in his hands, even though he'd played his entire life with the ball in his hands. And now he's slotting back into that. But with Reed, I think, yeah, he's just unique. It's you generally don't get drafted in teams that are as competitive as good as we are.
I'm curious if you see him. You know, a lot of us looked at him at college and saw Mark Price potentially because he can really shoot it from distance.
You're dating yourself. Most of the audience is like, who the hell is?
I know I can say that to you, and you know Mark Price, and will know Mark Price. But and that's quite a compliment. I mean, he had that off the bounce, you know, quick rise, mid range game, coming off of screens. Do you see him in that kind of role where he can play the one? Like, how do you envision him? How do you and Ime envision his role positionally, off the ball, on the ball? Is he good enough to be on the ball and get others involved as a ball handler?
If he becomes the player we want him to become, for sure. Yeah, like, I think he's – yeah, I wouldn't have drafted him that high if I didn't think he had a bunch of on-ball equity. He really sees the court really well. He's kind of a special playmaker on top of his shooting ability, and he's actually a really good athlete. That's one of the things that I always talk to him about is like, I'm not giving you any passes.
Like 41 inch vertical. As somebody who does combine stuff for the NFL, I've got an issue with this run up. Although I will say it's actually more like a real game.
How you play the game.
It's actually like in the NFL where,
right.
And so I saw I pay attention to this stuff. I'm like, okay, I think it was 36, 38, 39 inches flat, just straight up. And with a running vertical, it was over 40. So, yeah. I mean, a guy can – no, he can leap.
He's explosive. He can really go. He's fast. Like, and he's got a little twitch to him. And he's not – and he's strong. Like, he's not light.
Is he strong enough?
Yeah.
Because I wonder if he's strong enough to defend twos, though.
He will be okay. Like, and he's getting – like, he's way stronger now than we got him. He's going to be a big – solid kid who can – who can move. But people look at him and they think and they think he's not an NBA athlete. That's just not right.
Real quick, can you shine a light on a trade that didn't happen that you can talk about now that's fun to
I won't do that.
I probably not,
but right, go for it.
I don't know. Anything that you can.
Oh, you were just saying any deal.
Yeah, like any deal that was in the works that was close to happening that just didn't happen for the Rockets when you've been working.
No, I wouldn't. That's not fair. Yes. The answer is I could. I will not, but I could.
And I'll ask you this. Did you ever have conversations about the big man from Greece in Milwaukee?
No, we didn't.
No
we didn't,
conversations?
No, like, no.
That's what the insider said.
No, Milwaukee, like, I really deal well with John Horst. I really like him, and John was very clear that they weren't doing anything. So, like.
That's what it appeared.
Who are you going to talk to? Right.
Once he says no, he says no. Bellstone, general manager for the Houston Rockets. We're excited. October is when basketball starts. Now, it used to be November, and it crept in October, and that's even earlier. You've got 26, 28 games on national television this year. Man, things have changed under your direction and the direction of Ime Udoka. We're really excited about Rockets basketball. Kevin Durant, a Rocket, and you got so many players who are still on the upward tilt. So things are looking up. Congratulations. Great job so far. But I know you know the accomplishments are not – you're not in the books yet, so you got to – you got to keep working and keep hunting, as you said. You're still the hunter.
No, there's no trophy for off seasons. So yeah, we're starting. Every year you start at the bottom. Everybody's 0-0, and you gotta earn what you get. And for those teams that think that it's going to be handed to them, it tends to be rough years.
Never is, and especially not in the West. Rafael, thanks for coming in studio. We appreciate it.
Appreciate it, guys.
All right, break it right here. ESPN 97.5.
You're back in the Veritex Community Bank Studios with John and Lance.
On ESPN 97.5 and 92.5.
All right, let's get into it quick because we've got professional boxer Giovanni Marquez in studio with us. He's got a fight coming up in September. Next up is going to be, when's your next fight?
September 20th.
September 20th. Yes, so sir. September 20th. Giovanni Marquez, the name Marquez for boxing fans is a big one. Raul Marquez is your dad.
Yes,
not
sir.
Only your dad, but your trainer.
Yes, sir.
What was it like, before we get into your career, growing up? I grew up as a son of a football coach. What was it like growing up the son of a professional fighter?
I would say as a younger boy, it didn't really dawn on me much. I just always looked at my dad as my dad, but as I got older and we'd go to these big fights, people would always come up to him asking for pictures, and celebrities like Floyd Mayweather would embrace my dad, and I would just be like, wow, he must have done something in this sport to get this recognition.
The Mexican fight culture, I mean, and your dad was one of these guys, and there's a lot of them. One of my favorites all time was Julio Cesar Chavez Senior. But, there is a history of you're going out on your shield. Like it's heart. No bad fights. It's all action. And your dad was one of those fighters. What's your style? How much of that do you bring into how you approach the fight game?
I have that in me as well, but I do also have my skills. I would say I'm a bit more of a skillful fighter. I have more footwork, defense, and stuff like that. But at the end of the day, if I have to bring that out of the bag to get
it's
the win.
It's still in there.
It's in there for sure. It's
like, still in there. Every kid wants to beat their dad at like basketball or golf or like whatever it is. Did you ever beat your dad in boxing? You ever get into it with your dad when you're training, especially? Like, is that harder for you?
Oh, we still get in the ring now.
Yeah.
And yeah, we spar to the body.
How old is your dad now?
He's in his 50s.
He still got it?
He's still game.
That old man strength.
Yeah, he has that strength.
That grown
yeah,
strength.
Yeah, he has the strength, and then he has the knowledge, the veteran experience. So he'll pull some random tricks out the bag, and I'm like, okay.
Yeah. Bite the ear.
Yeah. What have you learned? What are some random tricks? Because a lot of times you get later in your career, you got to know the tricks.
Right.
When you're young, you don't know them as much. You don't need them as much. When you're older, you do learn the tricks, and you use them. Like, can you give us an example of one?
Kind of like when you're on the inside and the ref's on this side and, he hits you in the leg, those kind of things. Like,
it really has an impact?
Yeah, for sure, man. getting hit in the leg with those 8-ounce gloves, you're not able to move as much.
So you're 13-0, six knockouts. You're going to be fighting here in Houston. Most of your fights have come in Houston. You had, oh, look at this. You fought in Fort Bend. You fought in Rosenberg. That's my hood. You fought out there. You're going to be at the Bayou Music Center is where your next fight is going to be.
Yes, sir.
It's a bigger venue than the ones you've been in recently, I think,
as
you move up. And our good friend Sal and Taqueria Sarandas are your sponsors. You got a plate of food in front of you. We kind of did that for appearances. You're not actually, you got to make weight. So
yeah,
I'll eat that.
Chilaquiles and refried beans and taquitos. That can't probably be on the diet a lot. Maybe after the
fight. Yeah, yeah. This is some type of food I'll definitely celebrate my win with. But right now on the weight cut, unfortunately can't eat this.
No, no. How tight do you have to be with your training in terms of how close do you stay to weight before you have a fight? How much do you have to cut before a fight?
Between 15 and 20 pounds.
You'll have to cut between 15 and 20?
Yes, between now and then?
Probably about.
How the hell do you do that? And like,
well, how far away are you right now? 1 month away. How far are you away?
About 10, 15. Bro.
Okay, so it's more of a process.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How much the last week will you have to cut?
Probably about 10.
Saunas?
Yeah, yeah. The last 10 is like water.
But it's intentional.
Yes.
It's intentional because you want to keep your weight up for strength.
Right, for sure. Yes, sir.
Did you ever have to learn a lesson about cutting? Did you ever have to cut too much and you were weak going into a fight?
No, I try not to cut too much to avoid being weak. So I just do what I feel comfortable with, which it's never comfortable. It's always difficult, but without pushing it too much.
Yeah. Stylistically, you talked about differences from your dad. And there has been a culture of we're just going to slug it out. And you talked about being more skilled. Stylistically, where's your, like, as your trainer, how is he with developing that style for you? What is his, like, how much of this is you wanting to do that? And how much of this is his vision for you?
I would say my dad, he's very open-minded. And not only was he a world champion Olympian, he was also a commentator for many years. So he sees all the styles and he sees the benefits of a style like mine, and he takes my strengths and my weaknesses and just molds it together and just, you know, lets me be me and also adds in what needs to be added in.
Obviously, UFC and MMA is popular. Did you ever entertain that route, or always boxing because your dad?
Always boxing because of my dad and just my love for the sport, but I am a big fan of the UFC and the MMA. So
would you ever go that route?
I probably wouldn't, but I'm a fan of it for sure.
Yeah, and I think that's what, you know, as a fan of both, for a long time, it's funny how people tried to make it one or the other, and more people, you know, Dana White came from the boxing world when he went in there, and more people are just fight game fans. You know, they're different. It's a different style of fighting, but it's both combat
sports. Yeah, for sure. I'm a big fan of the UFC. I like that the best fight the best in there. It's not so much about business. And, you know,
I always wondered. And so that was a problem with boxing for so many years, is it was too political. You had different, you know, different promoters would avoid different fighters. I think for years, Mayweather Pacquiao should have happened a long time ago. They both fought when they were out of their prime. Well, certainly Manny was out of his prime. And I feel like because best fight best, and it's okay if you lose in mixed martial arts and the UFC, I wondered if that's having a positive impact on boxing to where maybe work, because it feels like boxing's starting to get more best on best.
Yeah, for sure. The Saudis are getting involved, so they're pumping a bunch of money, which is making the big fights happen. And Dana's getting into boxing too. He's promoting the Canelo Crawford fight. So,
are you happy about it? Do you like that?
I'm not against it. I'm for it. Yeah.
Anybody who can bring the sport up.
Yeah, for sure. My dad's actually working the Canelo Crawford fight in Spanish.
For Dana. Commentator?
Yes, sir.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be really awesome. Well, before we let you go, once again, thank you to Taqueria Sarandas for bringing you in here for us. You and I are going to cut a little commercial here in a second. We got some great food. Thank you to Saul and the good people over there. And once again, if you want to get tickets, it's going to be September 20th at the Bayou Music Center. We are going to have some information for you next week, or as the fight comes up, we'll have some information on how you can get some tickets. Maybe we get some tickets to give away as well, and get some more Houston fans in there, pack the place out for you.
For sure.
Giovanni, 13-0 with six KOs, looking to make it 14-0 with seven KOs. We'll seventh round TK.
First round knockout.
Not for sure. Seventh round TK. You got to wear him down.
Yeah, break him down a little bit. Yeah, yeah.
At 140 pounds, you're not gonna, there's not a lot of first round knockouts. I could be wrong, but it's kind of a wear down roll.
Yes, sir.
Listen, thank you once again for repping Houston and coming in here. And we look forward to checking out that fight September 20th.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. That's going to do it. Thanks to Will Conkle, to Rafael Stone, Heather Denich, Jesse Rogers. We appreciate you guys for listening. Keep it right here on ESPN 97.5. Dell and Sean Mapes up next.
You're listening to ESPN 97.5.
Bye, bitch.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Saving money on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Menards has a huge selection of concrete and mortar mixes. Our concrete products are great for a variety of applications, including pouring a walkway, setting a post, or even installing stone veneer. View our entire selection of concrete mixes and supplies in-store and on Menards.com. Plus, check out the weekly flyer for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the Board of Directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.